Thanks. So what I want to talk about is basically a paper that was on the archive about a year ago, which grew out of me thinking we're kind of approaching the era where fault tolerance experiments will be done. So I wanted to think about kind of what was needed to do these experiments, what they would look like. So to get started, let me make a distinction between quantum error correction and quantum fault tolerance. They're related things, of course, but quantum error correction is what's kind of the basic tool where you encode some qubits using extra qubits. And error correction is specialized for the case where your gates are perfect. So for instance, you can use it in communication where the main source of error is in the channel between Alice and Bob. But Alice and Bob, their quantum computers are good enough that you can kind of neglect any errors that might happen in them. So in particular, error correction is assuming that you have a perfect encoding procedure and a perfect decoding procedure. And therefore, it's not so useful for building a big quantum computer, where, in fact, the errors in the gates are kind of the main thing that we have to worry about. So for instance, if you use a quantum error correcting code that can correct one error per block, then in the communication context, if you have one error that occurs during the communication, you're fine. But if you have two errors, that's a problem. So if errors are independent occurring with probability p, say, then using the error correcting code reduces the rate of error from something of order p to something of order p squared. And so that's when p is small, that's an improvement. And there have been lots of experiments going back probably almost 20 years by now that have demonstrated quantum error correcting codes in various different systems. Now, fault tolerance, on the other hand, is a kind of more demanding protocol. It's something that uses quantum error correcting codes but puts on top of them a bunch of additional procedures which kind of relaxes this condition that you have to have perfect gates. So in particular, it doesn't assume you have perfect encoding, it doesn't assume you have perfect decoding or error correction procedures. And it also lets you do gates on states while they're encoded in the quantum error correcting code. So fault tolerance is what we need to build a big quantum computer when the gates are going wrong, kind of at some hopefully low error rate, but it's over the course of a large computation, it's unlikely that we'll get by without any errors at all. Fault tolerance is supposed to reduce the error from order p to order p squared or even smaller, depending on kind of what strength protocol you're using. The drawback of fault tolerance, of course, is that it's much more complicated. So it requires more gates, it requires more extra qubits. And the upshot of this is it also has more, I should say, stringent requirements on what the error rate is. And the upshot of all those things is that, in my opinion, it has not yet been demonstrated experimentally, although there have been a few attempts in the last year, which I'll talk about in a little bit. Okay, so the first question to ask, then, if somebody sets out to do an experiment demonstrating fault tolerance, what they have to do, okay? And so we want to come up with a condition that these fault tolerance experiments have to satisfy, a criterion. And in order to do that, we need to think about the circumstances of this problem. So normally when people think about fault tolerant protocols, they say, let's go on this, you know, reducing order p to order p squared. So usually that's happening because we're designing fault tolerant circuits so that a single error that happens is not going to mess you up. We have an error correcting code that can correct one error. So in particular, we want a single error to only cause a single fault, a single gate going wrong, to only cause one error in a block of the code. But that's clearly not suitable for an experiment, right? Because that's just a theoretical criterion. It doesn't tell us whether the experiment has actually successfully implemented this or not. Moreover, there's a lot of assumptions that go into that. So we need a criterion that satisfies the following conditions. Not really working. On the side. This one. Okay, so first of all, obviously we need our criterion to distinguish fault tolerant circuits and implementations fault-tolerant implementations from non-fault-tolerant ones. And we need it to make sense in small systems, because the first experiments will certainly be small systems, whereas a lot of criteria that you might come up with are good for asymptotically large systems. And I'll get to that, some examples in a minute. And of course, the important one is it's experimentally accessible, that we have something that we can directly measure. And one aspect of this is that we shouldn't make too many assumptions about what the errors are in the system, right? When I said before that, oh, it's reducing errors from order p to order p squared, that was under the assumption that errors were probabilistic, that I can say there's a probability of an error, and also that they're independent from qubit to qubit. But in real experimental systems, there will be some correlations between errors, so there's some chance of having two qubits go wrong at once, and errors will be coherent errors. There will be non-Markovian errors where the system is interacting with some environment which has a memory, doesn't get wiped out by the next gate. And all of these things could potentially affect the performance of your fault-tolerant protocol. And so we want a criterion that's saying not only is the error rate low enough to make fault tolerance work, but it doesn't have too many of these types of errors that could potentially mess up our fault-tolerant protocol. And you can't do that at a purely theoretical level. And you can't do that if you say, oh, this protocol works if we make this assumption about the error model. Right? So we have to come up with a criterion that doesn't depend on that to the greatest extent we can. And I want something that's fairly natural. So it's possible to come up with some criteria which kind of meet these other conditions but depend on some arbitrary parameter. And then if you change the parameter, maybe your experiment is not fault tolerant under this definition, whereas it would be for a different value. When I started this, I thought it would be easy to come up with definitions of what fault tolerance was and apply them to the circumstance, but it's really not. So there's a bunch of different kinds of definitions that you can think of. So one of them is kind of similar to that one I mentioned on the first slide, that it's reducing the error scaling from something of order p to something of order p squared. And at a theoretical level, this, as a starting point, seems pretty good, but it has a couple of problems. So first of all, even at a theoretical level, it's making some assumptions about the nature of the error model, right? It's saying that there is an error parameter that's, say, the probability of error, and that the logical error rate is changing according to how you change that real parameter. But in reality, there's, and even theory reality, there's many different parameters that affect what's going on in the system, right? And they can all potentially change independently. So at a minimum, you'd have to get something much more complicated than just looking at scaling of a single parameter. But more importantly, in the real experimental system, you don't get to tune the error rate the way you want to. Even if there is only one error parameter, you can't turn a knob on your experiment and say, oh, I'm going to turn the error rate down really low and see what happens. Right? I mean, it would be a lot easier if you could do that, but you can't. So what you're doing is you're stuck with whatever error level is actually in the system, and that's not, there's no direct way to test scaling. So another thing you could do is you could say, well, what about scaling with the size of the circuit? Right? So one version of this would be to say, okay, I can run certain experiments without the fault tolerance, and I can do circuits that are this big. With the fault tolerance, I can run circuits that are bigger. Okay? And so that's not a bad thing to do. There's kind of two versions of it that you could come up with. One of them would be some sort of asymptotic scaling that says, well, the overhead required to make this work, I mean, if you didn't do any error correction, the probability of getting error is still very high. You have to try again and again and again until you finally succeed. And that would have kind of exponential scaling. Whereas fault tolerance typically has much better scaling, say polylogarithmic. That's clearly not applicable to experiments because that's an asymptotic thing. But you could also say, well, I just want to do anything that's bigger. But in order for this to be meaningful, you have to set some sort of cutoff error rate. And so this is an example of that sort of arbitrary parameter that comes in. And so this kind of works, but it's arbitrary in my opinion, and so I don't want to use it. So another thing you could say is, are we below the threshold for fault-tolerant computation? So there's this threshold theorem which says if there's some value error value. And if you're below that threshold value, then you can do arbitrarily long quantum computations. Okay? And so that's a really attractive thing as an experimentalist. You can get below that threshold value, you know that you don't have to work too much harder on the error rate. I mean, it's still nice to have it lower, but it's not essential anymore. You can do then let the theorists do the work and apply software that will let you do arbitrarily long quantum computations, provided that you, the experimentalist, can make enough qubits to do that. And so certainly, if you can convincingly show that you're below the threshold, that would indicate that you're capable of doing fault tolerance. But there's a couple of things to notice about this. One is that you don't actually have to do a fault tolerance experiment to demonstrate that you're below the threshold, right? If you know what the threshold value is, then you just have to do some measurement of what the errors are in your system, and you say, oh, and I'm below the threshold. Therefore, I can do arbitrarily large quantum computations. But the other aspect of this is that that's assuming that you know what the threshold is, which in practice we don't, right? So even for very simple error models, we have some estimates of the threshold. And so if that's actually what's going on in your system, then by measuring the error rate, you could see that you're below that. But for more complicated error models, we really don't know what the threshold is. And so that's something that's again, making a big assumption about the nature of the error model and our ability to analyze the theory behind it. Yeah?
I don't really understand exactly what you're trying to test. So if you could actually test a three-level concatenated error correction within a circuit,
right,
and know that the error goes according to the right thing, would you be satisfied? Or is this something that you would say, yes, I've tested full
error? Yeah. So, okay. And this is actually very relevant. John Martinez is planning not to do the concatenated code, but scale up the Tor code and look at different sizes to see how the scaling goes. And, I mean, so all of this is experiment. So it's not going to reach the level of rigorous proof. If you could show me a system where, you know, you're looking at some family of codes and the error rate really drops dramatically, then probably, yes, I would be convinced that you're below the threshold. When accompanied by theory that says that actually this scalable system does have the threshold and it's not just some temporary thing that will cut off at some point. That's I think, a much more difficult thing to do. I think it will require scaling to pretty large sizes before you really, and maybe very much lower physical error rates than we have now, before you can convincingly demonstrate that. If you can show that, then that would be great. But I'm looking at a kind of a shorter term thing. And for these first experiments, how would you say, as a fair criterion, did they or did they not demonstrate fault tolerance? Okay? Sort of. Maybe we come back to the discussion. Okay, so here's a definition that I came up with. So first of all, let's do a little bit of structure here. So a fault-tolerant protocol we can think of as just a map from ideal circuits, unencoded circuits, into encoded circuits. So C is the unencoded one, C prime is the encoded one. And in order for this to make sense as an encoding, it's not just a map between these circuits, but there should be some connection between them. So the output qubits of C prime can be decoded. So you make some measurements on these output qubits, get some classical outcome, and you do some classical post-processing that's going to decode them so that they match the outputs of C. Okay? I'm going to assume that they have exactly the same probability distribution, although probably just very close is good enough. And I'm also going to consider the case where we have maps that don't work for all ideal circuits, just some subclass of circuits, some family of circuits. And usually, although this is not necessarily required, when we have a fault-tolerant protocol, it's built out of gadgets, where the map is constructed in such a way that you take each gate or state preparation or measurement, and you have some little bit of fault-tolerant circuitry that you replace it with. Okay? So you replace the physical qubits of the ideal circuit with logical qubits encoded in error-correcting code, and you replace each circuit element with the corresponding gadget on the fault-tolerance side. And then you have to stick an error correction somewhere, too. Okay, so here's my definition. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at for all circuits in this family, we're going to say, okay, we can implement this circuit in an unencoded way in this system. And if we do that, we get some error rate. What's the error rate? Well, we can compare the output probability distribution in the actual experiment to the ideal probability distribution, theoretically speaking, for the same circuit. Okay? And you can measure, say, the statistical distance between these two probability distributions. Okay, so that's the error rate for the unencoded version of the circuit. And then you can do the same thing for the encoded version of the circuit after decoding, right? So you run the encoded version, you get the output probability distribution, you decode it according to this rule up here, and then you compare it again to the ideal unencoded version of the circuit. Okay, so that's the error rate of the encoded version. And the criterion is simply this. For all circuits in this family, the error rate of the encoded version is less than the error rate of the unencoded version. Okay? So this is clearly kind of one of the goals of fault tolerance, that it should reduce the error rate. And so that's what I'm putting into this definition. So so there's a lot of ways you can kind of cheat on this definition. And some of them I can discuss. Some of them I'll just have to say, well, just don't try to cheat. So example, one way you can cheat very easily is you say, oh, well, there's this classical post-processing where I'm decoding the outcome of the distribution, right? Well, you could say, well, okay, I'm going to just discard what came out of the experiment and do some big classical simulation that's going to determine what should happen. Okay, that's clearly cheating, right? Don't do that. So another way to cheat is by saying, well, this family F, I've selected it so that it's only the circuits that, you know, I get some improvement and I'll ignore the other ones. So that's also cheating. Don't do that. But more generally, this family F should be some kind of reasonable family of circuits. Normally, what we'll do is we'll just say, oh, it'll be all state preparations within some set, all measurements within some set, and all gates that we can do. Okay, which might not be a universal set of gates, and so that's why it's a non-universal family. But it's still kind of all possible combinations of things we can do up to some size, because again, this is a limited size experiment. So another thing that's important is that all this stuff should be done for complete circuits, where you start with classical instructions, you prepare some qubits, you do some gates, you measure all the qubits, and you get some output distribution. This is not in the regime of we have some qubits sitting around and we're going to use them. And part of the reason for that is because we want to compare between the ideal circuit and the unideal circuit, but also because that's what we really have in experiments, right? We have to look at the classical inputs and outputs. That's all we have direct access to. And another important thing is that, that we should be comparing in the same system. Right, so for instance, if your ideal circuits have two logical qubits, you might be tempted to say, oh, I'm going to look at a two-qubit system, and I'm going to do an experiment, the unencoded experiment there, and then if I need, you know, five qubits for the encoded version, I'll go to a five-qubit system and do the experiment there. The problem is those are different systems. Their error rates are not directly comparable. It's not a fair comparison. Actually, in that case, you're probably making it harder for yourself because it's easier to make a two-qubit system than a five-qubit system. But whatever is going on, you should compare in the same system. And another thing I didn't write down, but it was kind of underlined on the last slide, is that this really has to be true for all circuits in the family. That's important. And actually, this is the distinction between an error correction experiment and a fault tolerance experiment. So in an error correction experiment, what do they do? Well, they prepare some states, they wait for a long time, and then they do error correction and measure. And if you wait for a really long time, the error correction experiment, even though the circuits are not fault tolerant, will still see a decrease in the error rate. Because the error there is dominated by the errors that happen while you're waiting, where the error correcting code is actually helping. But if there's an error in the state preparation or in the measurement, then it doesn't help. So if you do a short time where you prepare and then you immediately measure, then the error correction experiment will see a worse error rate, right? So that's an example where you had to pick basically the right family. You had to pick the family that varied the time. Otherwise, you're not seeing that the circuits that you're doing are not actually fault tolerant. Okay? So we need to do all this so that we're measuring all parts of the circuit to see that they're actually being improved by the circuitry that we're doing, encoding. Okay, so if you actually want to do this type of experiment, there's a lot of complications besides the obvious one of just getting a quantum computer that has enough qubits and low enough error rates that you could hope to succeed. So first of all, if you think about scaling these up to larger sizes, well, if we have many logical qubits, remember we're supposed to calculate the error rates by comparing the measured error rates versus the ideal, the measured probability distribution versus the ideal probability distribution. And to do that, you have to know what the ideal probability distribution is. So for small experiments, I don't think this is a big problem, right? If it's 2-3 logical qubits, you can easily simulate that. But if you get up to like 50 logical qubits, well, obviously that's becoming a problem. Another big problem is that these probability distributions are going to be pretty close, right? Because the error rate is low. And so you're going to need a lot of statistics to have good enough estimation of what those probability distributions are to have a reasonable estimate of the error rate. Again, for small experiments, probably you can do that. But as you start to scale up, that's going to be a problem as well. And finally, you don't want to have to actually do every circuit in the family, because there's just too many, right? Even when there's only a limited number of gates that you're doing, it's growing very rapidly with the length, the both number of qubits and the depth of the circuit. Okay, so that last one I'll probably get back to in a little bit, but let me first give you an example of the sort of experiment that I'm talking about. So so this, to me, would be the smallest type of experiment that you could do that would actually satisfy these criteria and let you see that fault tolerance had been done. And so it's going to be using a 4-qubit code. So the 4-qubit code has these four code words, so it has 2 logical qubits. Has stabilizer XXXX, ZZZZ. And this 4-qubit code is a distance 2 code, which means it can't correct arbitrary errors in an unknown place, but it can detect an error. So this is going to be an error detecting code experiment. And that means that the experiment we're going to do is going to be a post-selected experiment. We're going to run it. If we detect an error, we reject it. If we don't detect an error, we keep it. And we look at the error rates there. There's always dispute as to whether post-selection is good or not. I think it is in this case because for 2 reasons. So one of them is that this type of post-selection is used a lot in fault-tolerant protocols to prepare ancilla states. So from that point of view, this is definitely going to be an experiment about fault-tolerant state preparation. But the other reason is I think that this type of experiment with post-selection is already enough to kind of see the interaction of the errors with the error-correcting code in the fault-tolerant protocol, which is really kind of the point of doing these things. Okay, so maybe I'll run low on time, so I'll skip a little bit. So, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to use 5 physical qubits. So the code only uses 4 qubits. The 5th qubit is going to be the ancilla qubit that I'm using to check that I'm preparing the right states. So measurement is pretty straightforward. Measurement of the logical qubits, which combines with error correction, which you just measure every qubit, post-select on having even parity. So if you look at these code words, the correct code words always have either 0, 2, or 4 ones in them. Whereas, if we see an odd number of ones, we know that there's been an error. That's how you detect an error in the Z basis. And then the first logical qubit and second logical qubit can be deduced from the parity of 2 particular qubits. State preparation is more complicated. So the plus 0 logical state can be made just as 2 EPR pairs. That's kind of straightforward. But for the logical zeros, we need to do a little bit more. And that's what we need this extra ancilla for. So these 5 qubits are going to be arranged in a ring. It's enough that each of them only talks to its neighbor in the ring. And so here's some circuits to make. This one is that plus 0 state with 2 EPR pairs. And this one is the more complicated logical 0, 0. So logical 0, 0 is 0, 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 1. So it's a cat state. And so we can easily make that using this kind of circuit. But the problem is that if there's an error in one of those gates, then we could get something that looks like, say, 0011 plus 1100, which is a valid code word, but it's the wrong logical state. And so what we want to do is we want to do two C knots to this ancilla qubit to check if they're the same or not. And it turns out, if you look at all the possibilities, that this will detect any error that changes the logical state. Now, of course, there'll be some errors that only get one qubit wrong, but that's okay. They'll be detected at the end. Okay? And so once we prepare this logical state, we do some gates. There's some set of gates that we can do transversally as a tensor product on this four-qubit code. And so here's a list of them. So we do some mix of those, and then we measure. Okay? And so that's our family of circuits. It's going to be everything that starts with either this state or this state, then does some gates from this family, and then measures. We should probably limit to gate sequences of some given size, because after all, it is only a four-qubit code, and it's only detecting errors. We can't expect it to detect too many errors, only detects one. So if we go too long, it's going to fail regardless of the fault tolerance. So we're going to cut off after some length, and that's going to be the family that we would ideally like to test, although obviously we're not going to do everything in it again. Okay, so what family of circuits should we test? This is the part where I start to become a little bit unhappy with the results in the paper. So remember I said I didn't want to make assumptions about the error model. And my criterion says that this property should be true, that we're reducing the error rate, should be true for all circuits in the family. The problem is that if I want to reduce the number of circuits that I'm testing, I have to make some kind of assumption about the errors. Because consider the following error model, okay? It's a non-Markovian system. There's an environment that just basically watches what gate is going on. And then when it sees a sequence of gates that corresponds to some particular circuit, it says, okay, now I'm going to mess up all the qubits. Okay? So if I don't do that particular circuit, if I don't test that particular circuit, I'm never going to see this error model. And I'm not going to see that it causes the system to fail. So any kind of sampling is never going to detect this type of error model. Of course, that's a totally artificial and unlikely error model. Okay? But you see, I'm already on the path of making some assumptions about what the error model is. So what I want to say is that instead of making any kind of rigorous assumption and proving anything rigorous, I'm just going to make some heuristic suggestion as to what I think a good family of subfamily of circuits would be. And so in particular, I think that it needs to be a family that's testing both relatively small and relatively large circuits within the family. Because, you know, if you are looking at things that build up over time, then non-Markovian effects build up over time, then you need to test long circuits. But you also need to test short circuits, because they emphasize state preparation and measurement, which are important parts of it. You should have some random circuits in there, of course, because that gives you some kind of sampling of the whole space. But you also need some non-random circuits, because, for instance, coherent errors are presumably going to build up more rapidly if you're doing the same gate over and over again than if you're doing some random sequence of gates, where coherent errors will tend to cancel out and become more probabilistic in nature. And of course, you want circuits that include all the different types of things that you have in your family, all the different types of gadgets, and some that have more of one and some that have more of another. Because, you know, if any of those gadgets is not working, you want to detect that. So basically, my concrete suggestion is you know, for a variety of lengths, you do random circuits, and you also choose the same gate or small sequence of gates, and you repeat it over and over again, varying number of times. And so I think that by testing circuits of this size, you can be reasonably well convinced that if you had tested arbitrary other circuits in the family, you would still have gotten the same result, that the error rate is decreasing. Okay, so now let me talk about the experiments that have been done so far, and basically all in the last year. So there's three of them. So there's an experiment by Chris Monroe's group at the University of Maryland with IonTrap. And all three of these experiments use this four-qubit code. Although this one and this one used a subsystem version of the code, where you have, instead of two logical qubits, you have one protected logical qubit and one unprotected logical qubit. And so the third one here is by the IBM group using superconducting qubits. And so this first and the third one, they basically what they did was they compared the error rates on the protected logical qubit and the unprotected logical qubit. And the reason I don't like that is the same reason that I said you shouldn't compare between, say, a 2-qubit system and a 5-qubit system. The two different logical qubits, they see different environments. And so they are going to have different error rates regardless of whether one of them is protected and one of them is not protected. And so I don't think you can really do a convincing demonstration if that's your only test. Now, I think both of these also did some tests where they introduced artificial errors, and they saw that they could detect those. That's maybe also, you know, kind of showing you something. But what it's showing you is that the circuit you designed, that you ran in this experiment, is fault tolerant in the theoretical sense. It's not really telling you anything about the interaction with the real experimental error. So again, I'm not happy with that. And then there was this experiment by a graduate student, Aachen, who actually is, I think, basically a theorist. He used the IBM quantum experience, you know, online thing. So it's the same computer that these IBM guys did, but he was doing it remotely. And he was following my paper. So he was trying to implement my criterion. But the problem is the quantum experience has limited connectivity. It doesn't have the ring connectivity. It has a different shape connectivity. And the upshot of that was that he ended up doing some non-fault-tolerant circuits. And sure enough, the non-fault-tolerant circuits had higher error rates than the unencoded version. But again, this to me is not a convincing experiment. You have to do all the circuits in the family using the correct criterion and using and see that the error rate decreases. Because there were other differences between the non-fault-tolerant circuits and the fault-tolerant circuits, and those might have been responsible for this difference. I should say that also all of these only did really state preparation and measurement, which for me would be enough. It would be a very small family, but it would be something. They didn't try really to do gates, but that would be a relatively straightforward, I think, further step if you got this part done. Okay, so let me make a couple of additional quick comments. So one of them is that a lot of experimentalists, I think, they have the inclination to say, oh, we prepared this state, which is the error-correct encode state. We did it in a fault-tolerant way. And now let's do state tomography to see what the actual state is. The problem with that is the state tomography involves a lot of additional measurements. And those measurements will have errors, too. And you're not protecting against those. The state tomography doesn't really tell you anything directly. Right? You can't separate the errors in the measurements from the errors in the fault-tolerant state preparation. This is the, kind of the reason why I was emphasizing doing complete circuits. Right? Again, that's all you have direct access to is the classical inputs and the outputs. So you can do stuff on the logical state, like randomized benchmarking. That's maybe a little bit more helpful. But again, all these things tend to make assumptions about the error rates. So I'm not totally happy with them, although they do indicate something. So one thing that I think is really valuable about these experiments is that they can have the potential to actually be experiments. So normally, when you're doing some kind of quantum protocol, teleportation or factoring or whatever, you're doing a demonstration. The theory is there. We know that teleportation works in theory. You're not testing whether it's going to work. What you are is demonstrating that you have the appropriate control and understanding of your system to actually implement this protocol. Fault tolerance can start that way, but there's more to it. Because the thing that's important in fault tolerance is the errors in the system. And so when you're doing a fault tolerant experiment, you're actually making a measurement of whether the errors in the system are compatible with the fault tolerant protocol that you're using. And because I'm out of time, maybe I'll not elaborate on that. But the goal of doing these fault tolerance experiments, I think, should actually be to teach us how real experimental errors can interact with these theoretical protocols. So let me just summarize. So the types of experiments that, the types of questions that I'm trying to answer that way would be, how do fault-tolerant protocols behave under these more general types of errors, where I said I didn't want to make assumptions? And in particular, it's not going to tell you about arbitrary theoretical cases, but it's going to tell you about the ones that really are occurring in the experiment. But we really are in the level where these experiments can be done in the short term. You just have to do basically what I said. You have to do some family of circuits and show that the error rate is decreasing when you apply fault tolerance. And then the next step would be to try to use these experiments to actually extract some of this information and to learn about the errors in the system by doing these fault tolerance experiments. Okay, I'm going to stop there. Thanks.
When we did our 9-qubit experiment, would you classify that as fault tolerant, but only for bit flips?
Yeah. So I would classify that as a demonstration of classical fault tolerance in a quantum system, basically
which is only bit flip. And I would say, good, because we hope to do that with bit and phase, and then do everything. And then I would say, if you look at our paper, we do go through and talk about the information we extract so that, you know, you can test a lot of what's going on there in the way that you want that.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a little bit of what I skipped. So going back a slide. So here's kind of an obvious way to go about trying to extract some of this information about how the errors, and the idea would be, well, you're making some assumption about the error, you simulate it classically, and you compare to what the experiment does, which I think is pretty much what you did. And if it matches pretty well, then great. Then it may not be that it's actually, say, a polychannel, but at least the polychannel is giving you a good approximation to experiments. And if that's true over a wide variety of experiments, then you can have some confidence that doing kind of bigger simulations with polychannels is a good thing to do. The problem is, what happens if it's not the same? And then you have to try to start to extract some additional information, and I'm not quite sure what to do then.
I'm also going to say that doing multiple rounds, the error correction, so error correction and time, I don't know if that fits in your definition, but this is clearly what you have to do to build a quantum computer, and certainly teaches you a lot about what's going on. So it'd be nice to somehow get that into the definitions in some way.
Yeah, so I'm not going to put it in the definition because I'm allowing families that kind of run for a limited amount of time where you don't have to worry about that. But it's definitely an attractive thing. So it's like, so for instance, I said I would accept a family that only involved preparation and measurement. Okay, so that's like maybe the first step. The next step is just insert some gates in between them. And the next step after that is to have, you know, repetitive error correction. I think it is definitely an important thing to include. And certainly by the time you want to get to universal families of gates, you also need to include repeated error correction. I should say that John Preskill pointed out to me some previous time I gave this talk that for this 4-qubit code, you actually can do repeated error correction if you convert it to the gauge version. And there you make 2-qubit measurements using the ancilla. So you have to reset the ancilla during the computation. You need more connectivity than just this ring, though. So that's a drawback.
I just had a clarification question. How do you define comparing like with like? Because if the encoding steps themselves are changing which qubits are important in the circuit, no?
Right. So obviously it can potentially depend on which physical. So let's take the case of this 5-qubit experiment, two logical qubits. So the unencoded version is going to be implemented on two of those physical qubits, and you get to pick which two. And in principle, it might depend whether you pick, you know, qubits 1 and 2 or qubits 4 and 5. So really, you should use the best ones, right? Because you want to make the comparison between the best thing that you can do without encoding versus what your encoding actually does. Obviously, if you manage to pick two really lousy qubits, then it's a more favorable comparison. It's easier to make the criterion. But again, I would count that as cheating.
But so then you have to decide which ones are the best one and through some kind of sampling of applying the circuits on them.
Yeah. Usually the experimentalists can figure this out.
Yeah.
So you said don't do tomography and
right.
Maybe don't do benchmarking, but I wasn't really clear on what you were advocating you should do.
Is sort
of logical measurements?
Yeah, so what I'm advocating you should do is you run the unencoded circuit, you measure the error rate. You run the encoded circuit, you measure the error rate by comparing the whole output probability distribution to the ideal one after decoding. And that's it, right? That's your whole data. Okay. I mean, in principle, you can go further and start to take data about what error syndromes show up with what probabilities. But for the first purpose of saying, did you do fault tolerance or not, that's all I want to look at. So all this other stuff, when I say don't do this, I mean, of course, you can do whatever you want. It's supplementary information. But it's not information that directly tells you whether you've done fault tolerance or not. That's what I mean. So for instance, if you do logical randomized benchmarking and you see, oh, my logical gate error rate is less than if I didn't encode, that doesn't quite tell you, right? That tells you that for a certain set of circuits, the average logical gate error rate is lower. It doesn't tell you whether you've made every gadget lower. It doesn't tell you about state preparation and measurement, whether those are better, that sort of thing. So that's why we don't want to use those things as evidence that you've succeeded in fault tolerance, except maybe supplementary evidence. They're not the primary evidence.
Sorry, one more thought. So you didn't want to make a lot of assumptions about it, but in practice, I would think that this is very dependent on how you pick that family. And as you start
the
scaling...
The family of circuits, yeah.
Yeah, and in particular, the ensemble you pick on it for how you actually measure it.
Right.
Because once you get along circuits, you could have that ensemble condenses on all kinds of particular kinds of gates and things like that. I mean, you were trying to avoid it by saying put in some short ones, put in some long ones,
yeah.
Put in some you put in by hand, put in some random ones, whatever. But that seems like as they get longer, it's harder and harder to control that it's not sort of focusing on something which isn't actually what you want.
Sorry, what do you mean by focus? You mean the family that you've done is focusing?
Well,
I mean the whole point is that if there's something that you're worried about, you should definitely put it in. And you could definitely choose things in a variety of different ways so that you don't get, you know, blindfolded and only look at one particular direction. That's kind of the goal of picking this family.
Right. But I mean, all I meant was that because you have to sample in order to do it, the criterion that all circuits get better is not really what you can check.
Well, you can't check it directly. So
it's all circuits with probability something that I can do, you know.
Well, yeah, but that's already making a much more rigorous statement than I would feel comfortable making, simply because I don't have any kind of underlying rigorous error model. I should say that there is some kind of intuitive error model here, which is, well, you know, coherences should build up on the same gates, and non-Markovian effects should have some limited time scale, and things like that. But they're not stuff that's very easy to put into a rigorous form, where you say, this is actually what's going on in the system within these parameters. And any kind of assumption that you make like that probably will not be literally satisfied. So that's part of the reason I don't want to say it that way.
OK, if there are no more questions, let's
go. Oh,
great. I mean, very naive question, which is, what is wrong with sort of having different fault tolerant codes for different, say, types of questions you might want to throw at a computer?
Oh, there's nothing wrong in principle. That's actually subsumed in this definition that I put up here. Okay. So this part here is just saying some map from ideal circuits to encoded circuits. So it could be that I look at this ideal circuit and say, oh, this is factoring, I should use this type of protocol. Or this is Grover's algorithm, I should use this other kind of protocol. And that's, so that's included in this. What is not included is this gadget idea. Okay, so this gadget thing is the way basically all fault-tolerant protocols that people talk about have been done so far. But it doesn't seem to me it's really an essential part. It's just something that makes it a lot easier.
Okay, we're out of time for this discussion. So let's thank Daniel again.